From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
If you've ever posted a photo on the massive community science project called iNaturalist and wondered how such contributions get used in research, well, today's guest is here to tell us about one especially stunning example. It involves 1.6 million such crowdsourced observations and the timing of the migration of hummingbirds in eastern North America. You've probably heard it said that hummingbirds love red flowers, and scientists in the Hopkins Lab at the Arnold Arboretum of Harvard University took a much closer look at that connection thanks to all that community data and the use of artificial intelligence to sort through it all. One of the Harvard scientists, a postdoctoral researcher in the Plant Evolution Lab named Patrick McKenzie, is here to explain what they learned and how. So more in a moment, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Patrick McKenzie has written that quiet hours in the sun meditating with the bugs, plants, and birds are my inspiration as an evolutionary biologist. Patrick is always on the lookout for patterns and then asking himself why each pattern unfolds, like the why of red flowers and hummingbirds, for example. He was part of the team at Dr. Robin Hopkins' lab at the Arnold Arboretum that published the hummingbird research that's our topic today. Besides his extensive training in plant evolution, Patrick is a keen birder, and I'm glad to welcome him to the show. Hi, Patrick. How are you?
Hi, Margaret. I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Yes. So on a non-hummingbird, non-red flower topic, I read that your favorite wildflower species is Monarda fistulosa, the wild bergamot or bee balm, and that you spent many hours watching bumblebees forage from its lavender-colored flowers. So that's one of your favorite observations that you like to go watch?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, Monarda fistulosa is one that I grew up around in Arkansas, and it's kind of followed me my whole life. So now there's a giant patch of it next to the building where I work. And so in the summertime, actually starting in just a few weeks, the Monarda fistulosa will be blooming here. And yeah, watching the pollinator interactions with them is really, really amazing because they're visited by bumblebees, very obviously, but if you stand around and watch long enough, you'll see all sorts of different insect visitors, occasionally hummingbirds too, come by to visit those flowers.
Yeah. So how did the question about the commonly sort of repeated notion that hummingbirds favor red and I think tubular and nectar-rich flowers, how did that sort of question get on your radar or something to look deeper into at the lab? And then that led to the publication, I believe it was last May, in the journal Current Biology, of your research. So where did that, you know, were you watching hummingbirds or red flowers or what happened?
Well, there are a few things. So the concept of what makes a hummingbird flower is something that scientists have talked about back and forth in the literature for a long time. And in whether it's truly a red flower preference for hummingbirds, whether that pattern, you know, that truly hummingbirds, you know, red flowers are more often hummingbird flowers, whether that's true to begin with. And then also there are these other physical characteristics that are common in hummingbird flowers, we think, like having a tubular shape. So like trumpet shaped flowers kind of, and being rich in nectar. That scientists have been trying to study at large scales for a long time. I think for us, there's this observation that if you track the flowering time or the phenology, the seasonality of when flowers are appearing in nature up the eastern U.S., I think a simple observation that was motivating for us is that flowers are appearing in the eastern US before hummingbird migration has occurred. So there's this couple of week long period, I think in like, late March or early April, like right before hummingbirds have, moved up to, say Virginia, New York, where I am in Massachusetts, where flowers are blooming, but the birds aren't here yet. And so I have this, this idea that like, if this is true, probably these hummingbird flowers are going to be underrepresented among the flowers that we see. And maybe we won't be seeing many of these red or orange tubular nectar-rich flowers.
Okay. So that got you wondering, but it wasn't like you could get 9 million researchers to go man the coast all the way from the overwintering grounds to the breeding grounds for a month or something, or a few weeks, or or even a week. I mean, how do you possibly? So you had this idea, right, of how you could possibly accomplish this.
So there's this history of these phenology studies being done, these studies of seasonality at local scale. So you can find like, within say like a state park or something, a botanist would have like sort of recorded the flowering phenology of the flowering time of these different plant species and published that in the literature. And so there was some of that like highly localized information, but kind of in parallel to all of this, I've been getting more and more fascinated with iNaturalists, this community science, or I call it community science. Other people call it citizen science or participatory science. It's all
Yes.
referring to these platforms by which anyone can walk around in nature with a cell phone and not have a science background, but still be contributing useful data. And iNaturalists is, I think, one of, if not the most popular platform by which people are often engaging with community science. And so I'm starting to get really excited just in all aspects of the science I'm doing with the opportunity to use this data to study natural history at these really giant scales. So like you said, yeah, it would be really, really difficult to send thousands of researchers up and down the eastern US to track when things are flowering and where hummingbirds are, right? But because we have people walking around with their cell phones taking pictures of plants and birds and uploading them to iNaturalist, we can do it from, our living room couch or, in my case, in the building where I work, I can look at observations from all over the country and all over the world. And so yes, I think in North America, there are millions of observations of flowering plants, and that provided a really amazing data set for us to dive into for this project.
And now you didn't really sit on your living room couch going through the pieces of data. You actually did something even more forward-thinking and modern, which is, I think you used artificial intelligence to help do the analysis. Is that correct?
Right, that is correct. And actually, so this idea is something that I originally had probably like I think I started trying to work on this with some friends during my PhD 5 or 6 years ago. And at the time, artificial intelligence as an opportunity for data processing wasn't really on our radar at all. And at the time, I took a bunch of people and a giant spreadsheet and tried to subdivide the work of manually labeling flower colors across the spreadsheet among, eight or 10 people, something like that. And I was like, if we all spend, 10 hours clicking rows, like maybe we can come out with a data set of like 10,000 labeled observations, and maybe that would be enough to study this phenomenon. And so fast forward to I think late 2023 is when I was able to revisit this project, and ChatGPT had just matured in kind of a new way. They'd introduced this computer vision model, and computer vision is something that I think is, famously hard for doing complex tasks, but really excels at very simple tasks. And so the kind of question that I had been asking up to this point was, looking at iNaturalist observations and asking, what flower color I'm looking at in a given image. And this is the exact kind of question that something like the ChatGPT vision model is really, really good at performing, answering very simple questions and then doing that many times. And so I was able to come back to this data set, and rather than, trying to rope in a bunch of people to just assemble a small data set, suddenly I could, turn the computer loose on this data set of, what ended up being a data set of 1.6 million observations.
Wow.
And for every observation, we can ask this very simple question of there is a flower in this image, out of this list of colors, yellow, blue, green, red, what color is the flower that you're seeing? And scaled up, massively, that becomes a very rich source of information that humans have a very difficult time assembling.
And so we know. Also, from other observations, we know where the hummingbirds are, like from the migration reports and so forth. Do we,
Yeah, that.
because I mean, I guess we should have, maybe we should say that, I mean, hummingbirds, they're not just taking nectar, they also act as pollinators to some of these plants too, right? It's a, is that correct? There's like a two-way relationship.
That's exactly right. Yeah,
Yeah.
the plants provide a service to the hummingbirds, and the hummingbirds provide a service to the plants. And it's thought that this specialization of sort of these physical traits of the flowers, of being red and of being tubular and of being nectar rich, are often more to the flower's benefit. I think specifically the specialization on red is thought to be the plants specializing to the hummingbirds. There's been some previous work showing that hummingbirds are really great learners, and if they are in an environment where there aren't red and orange flowers, that they can learn to find nectar in flowers of other colors, and that this red color that the flowers take help them stand out to the hummingbirds, to the exclusion of things like bumblebees. So they can specialize really well on hummingbird visitors for pollination, and then the hummingbirds help plants cross-pollinate with one another, which helps maintain diversity for the plants. But yes, getting back to your original question, hummingbirds are also very frequent in the iNaturalist data set. They're also tracked separately. There's a separate community science platform called eBird that has
Right.
loads of information about hummingbird migration as well. For simplicity for this paper, we just used the iNaturalist data set. But we did check informally to see that there's really good concordance in both data sets for tracking this like
Okay.
northward advancement of hummingbird migration.
So here you have all this data. It's getting analyzed by AI, and it's all, and what kind of, what did you find out? Because again, I've heard for years, oh, they like red flowers, or oh, and there may be some correlation to their migration patterns or whatever. Oh, they come at the time of, people say things, but sometimes it sounds like a little bit of of conventional wisdom or an old wives' tale. Oh, they come at the time of such and such flower, right? But not necessarily backed up by research. So what did you find out?
Yeah, so what we found was something that to me is really delightfully simple, which is that if you just forget about the species identity of all of these different flowers, if you just you take these 1.7 million observations and you break them down into colors, red, blue, green, yellow, we see this sort of perfect looking concordance in flowering time for everything that's not red and orange flowers. So basically, early in the year, all of these different colors start flowering in the southern United States on in the eastern half of the country, and then throughout the spring, this flowering advances northward. So we sort of have early in the year, everything's blooming in the south. Later in the spring, by May and by June, flowers are peaking in the northeast. And then red and orange really stand out as lagging behind in this northward advancement. And so, in March, in April, when the hummingbirds haven't yet arrived, there are basically no red and orange flowers blooming in the eastern US. And then as soon as the hummingbirds show up, we see this really perfect correlation in the northward advancement of the eastern US of hummingbird migration alongside where these red and orange colored flowers are appearing. And so it's the first time that this lag driven by flower color alone has been documented in the scientific literature. And as an evolutionary biologist, this is really exciting because it suggests something about a generality. Generalities can be hard to come by in evolution and in ecology because biology is just so messy. But it suggests there's this generality of a link between red and orange flowers, regardless of the evolutionary histories of these different species, and the time of the season at which they're appearing. And that's, we think, driven by the appearance of hummingbirds seasonally.
So because again, relationship, because over all these however many millennia, et cetera, beyond, relationship, is that why? I mean, the two organisms, or they're not two, but you know what I mean, the flowers of these colors and the hummingbirds, you know, is it, or I guess we don't, do we know that, or is that?
I think there's still more testing to be done. So what we have right now is a good correlation between the appearance of the red and orange flowers and the appearance of the hummingbirds. But I think it's, really highly suggestive of a coevolutionary relationship between these things. So, there is some dependence, right, on hummingbird presence of, success for these red and orange flowers and getting successfully pollinated. And yeah, I think for millions of years they will have been, building this relationship. And it's contingent on the fact that hummingbirds are migratory. So this aspect of flowering time is contingent on this completely separate taxon, which if you look, across on the other side of the country at the West Coast, like California, Anna's hummingbirds are there year round, and we don't see the same pattern. And so it's this process of migration in the ruby-throated hummingbirds in the eastern US that I think is driving this.
I kind of love that it's ruby-throated and that it's the red and orange flowers.
Isn't
I
it
just kind
nice?
of love that. It's all just very like styled, you know. It's
It
very
really is.
fashionable. So some of the flowers, just as an as examples that in this palette going up the country, are there some that people would recognize, you know, that as quote hummingbird plants kind of
Yeah, definitely. Some popular garden plants for native flower gardens. I think Lobelia cardinalis, cardinal flower, is one of the most frequent in the data set, as well as Aquilegia canadensis, wild columbine. If you're more in the southeast, Campsis radicans, the trumpet creeper, is a more common orange flower. Later in the season, we see jewelweed appear as well. So all of these, the data set's really interesting because yeah, it's dominated very much by some of these very, very, I think, common and showy flowers. I think something that, sort of innately appeals to me about these questions of hummingbird pollination is that I think the flowers that are very attractive to hummingbirds are also the flowers that are very attractive to me personally. So I think of these as being the very, the showy, charismatic flowers that are often associated with hummingbird pollination.
And it is interesting, you know, of course, now thinking about it, I'm thinking, well, you're completely right. I never thought of it consciously. I mean, I always thought about the part of early spring is pastel-y, right? But I never thought about the other part, dot dot dot. But the red and orange stuff comes later. You know, I didn't think of it exactly that way. I thought of what was present, not what was missing.
Well, for the early spring stuff, and actually just I think looking across all of the other ways that a flower can look, there are other types of pollination syndromes. So pollination syndrome is a word that's referring to, whether something is a hummingbird flower or a bumblebee flower or a fly flower, like these groups of traits that are associated with one type of floral visitor versus another. And so we have our, we've been talking about this red and orange, tubular, nectar-rich flower for hummingbirds. But there are also associated suites of traits with bumblebees, often having, spotting on the petals, sort of like, they often have like a landing pad for the bumblebees to hold on to. Just the sort of generalities of the appearance of these flowers. And in contrast, we have for fly-pollinated flowers, we often have, really strong aromas. They're often white or sometimes like maroon or brown. And, there are also, famous like hawk moth pollination syndromes, bat pollination, all of which are, generalities because these syndromes can arise sort of across sort of the tree of life, and might look slightly different in, agave versus morning glory or something, but still, you might see this trend toward, oh, if it's hawk moth pollinated, it might be white. I think what stands out here is that there is this lag, this seasonal lag in the appearance of ruby-throated hummingbirds that we don't see in like bumblebees versus flies. I think maybe we would also see a similar difference in flowering time of our bumblebee pollinated things and our fly pollinated things, except I think both of those groups of pollinators get, they become active around the same time of year. And so we don't see the same lag there.
It made me want to ask, we have maybe 3 or so, 4 minutes left. I want to, it made me want to ask about does this experience with this research done this way, using this kind of data, make you have, do you have now have a list of like all the other things you want to explore this way? He's
Yeah, I know.
laughing. I guess he
It
does.
can really spiral, can't it? I think yes, absolutely. I think iNaturalist and community science in general is something that, like, if we were to awaken a botanist from 200 years ago and show that person iNaturalist and what it can provide as a resource for asking these kinds of natural history questions at large scale, I really think it'd be absolutely mind-blowing for that person. It is a treasure trove that I think provides, endless opportunities for questions about the natural world. And so, yeah, I've started digging in more to, specific organisms. So we brought up Monarda fistulosa earlier, and we have a recent paper out about exploring flower color variation in Monarda fistulosa specifically. So rather than asking, are we looking at red versus yellow versus blue, we're asking, okay, all of these flowers are generally lavender colored, but like, is there variation in that color across space? And in that project, we find that all of the Western Monarda fistulosa seem to be this richer, deeper lavender than those in the East. And so I've explored that a bit more with more of an organismal target. There are also new discoveries every day with iNaturalist of new species, or it can be used to track sort of the spread of invasive plants too. So I'm thinking about these things as well. I think maybe in the short term, something I've been really excited about exploring in the future is to actually turn to eBird, this other community science platform, and browse through all of the images of hummingbirds and try to assemble a list or a map or something of if there is a flower being visited by the hummingbird in that picture, what type of flower is that? And can this community science data set also just generally support the idea that this physical association of this red tubular flower, really does hold up. Again, I think this is something that we generally know to be true, but every, different facet we can take to support that, I think, makes that generality more convincing.
And selfishly, I want to say, as a gardener, I always say to people, plant some hummingbird flowers, quote unquote, near your favorite windows
That's
because
right.
there's such little birds and they're fast and so forth, but it's so incredible to watch them up close, to have the privilege to watch them up close. Do you know what I mean? And
It
so,
really is.
I have some honeysuckle, Lannisura sempervirens, around a porch post right outside my kitchen windows, and so, and it's just like, I mean, just watching, it's just selfish but wonderful. So hopefully they're as happy as I am about it.
Yeah, well, they're so entertaining, right? And we had, yeah,
Exactly.
I've lived near Monarda didima before, the scarlet beetle,
Yes.
and yeah, really, really similar experience. It can provide a whole lot of entertainment when you, especially when you get more than one hummingbird,
Oh,
there
yes.
by your window. Yeah,
Yes.
they can be a lot of fun.
Well, Patrick McKenzie, I'm so glad to talk to you. And I was so glad that you shared with me in correspondence and so forth recently this research and alerted me to this, because this is just really fascinating, both the process and what you learn. So thank you. And I hope I'll talk to you again soon. And happy birding meantime, right?
That's
All
right. Yeah. Thank you so
right.
much. It's been a pleasure.
And thanks to all of you for tuning in too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as at awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, HighMowingSeeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, WhiteFlowerFarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of AwayToGarden.com and RobinHoodRadio.com.